Okay, so maybe we can start. And today I want to start looking at the individual factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And of course, the first factor being right view. So we're going to start looking at right view this morning here. And to form the kind of the main sutta that I've used to look at the various factors of the path is a sutta called the Vibhanga Sutta. And Vibhanga in Pali means something like analysis. So analysis, the idea is that you analyze each factor. And many of the sets in Buddhism, many of the different categories of factors of the path, etc., they have this kind of analysis where they explain in detail what these path factors are about. This is going to be the kind of sutta which recurs all the way through. And then I'm going to use that and then explain that in detail as we go along here. So this is from the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Magga Sanyutta, sutta number 8, called the Vibhanga analysis in English. So this is how it starts. At Sabbati, bhikkhus, I will teach you the Noble Eightfold Path, and I will analyze it for you. Listen to that and attend closely. I will speak. Yes, Venerable Sir, those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. What, bhikkhus, is the Noble Eightfold Path? It is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. And what, bhikkhus, is right view? Knowledge of suffering, knowledge of the origin of suffering, knowledge of the cessation of suffering, knowledge of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called right view. So there you are, that's right view. That's it. So very straightforward. It is about the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, right? Again, they use the word knowledge, of course, in English translation. The Pali word is jnana. And again, here it means knowledge has many different levels to it, right? They have the real knowledge, which is the insight knowledge that you have when you become a stream enterer. That's, of course, the true knowledge. And that is what this means. In the end, this is what this means. It means the knowledge of the stream enterer. And that is when right view becomes firmly established. But prior to the knowledge of stream entry, there are still other levels of understanding of these Four Noble Truths. And for the majority of people, it is those preliminary levels of understanding that we're talking about when we talk about the Four Noble Truths. So I think it's important to see that there are different levels of this thing we're called jnana, and it doesn't necessarily mean stream entry. It also means a lesser understanding. And that lesser understanding of right view, the lesser idea of right view, is also explained in a completely different way. And that is something I will look at later on, is the looking at how is right view explained? What is the second way of looking at right view? And for many people, that is perhaps more important because it's more practical. It's more kind of something you can actually understand immediately, whereas the Four Noble Truths obviously are very lofty teachings, and the full understanding of them is obviously very profound. So, but that's essentially what it is. So I would like to take some time to look at these Four Noble Truths, because they are obviously very interesting here. And there's many aspects to these Four Noble Truths that are perhaps not necessarily so obvious. So it's quite interesting to go into a little bit of detail, at least. Not a great amount of detail, but a little bit of detail what these Four Noble Truths actually mean. And then by doing that, we can approach perhaps this idea of right view a little bit and in our own understanding of these things. So this next extract is from the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, a setting in motion of the wheel of the Dhamma. And this, of course, as we have seen before, is the first discourse by the Buddha. So this is where he kind of is establishing his dispensation. His sasana is being established, right? And of course, when he establishes his sasana, the main teaching of the Buddha, that is what he expounds. And elsewhere in the suttas, you find, for example, in the Mahahati Padopama Sutta, the greatest sutta on the elephant's footprint, when the Sariputta specifically says that the Four Noble Truths are like the framework that encompass all other teachings, right? You have the simile of the elephant's footprint, which fits all other footprints inside of it. In the same way, the Four Noble Truths fit all other teachings inside of them. So this is like the overview. It's another way of understanding the kind of the completeness, the fullness of the, it's like the overall picture, the bird's eye view, if you like, another way of seeing these, this Dhamma. Let us have a look at this in a bit of detail and see what it has to, what the Buddha has to say about these things. Okay, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus of the group of five thus. Bhikkhus, these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What to? The pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, the way of the worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. And the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. Okay. So this is the very beginning, the first teaching of the Buddha, right? This is how he starts off his dispensation by giving this particular teaching here. And it might be useful perhaps just to remind ourselves very quickly of the history of the Buddha struggle prior to this, because this fits in with that history of the Buddha struggle. Remember the Buddha when he was living the lay life, before he became a monk, before he decided to renounce his ordinary life. He lived a very luxurious life by the standard of that time. It is described in the sutta that he had three houses, right? Three pasadas, one for the winter, one for the summer, one for the rainy season. It described how he had the best clothes, always all khasi cloth. He had the best kind of food and all of these kind of things. So he lived a very luxurious life for those days. And then he decided to abandon that because he realized that this does not solve the fundamental problems of life. The fundamental problems of life, of course, as he defined them, was in particular death, old age, sickness, etc., etc. This doesn't solve it. In fact, it makes it worse because, as he says in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26, he says that I'm subject to all these problems myself. And now what I'm doing is I'm going out and I'm attaching to other things which are also subject to these problems, right? I have these problems. Then I go and get a wife. I go and get children. And they have the same problem. And all I'm doing is creating more suffering for myself in the future. Because whenever you enjoy something, whenever there is an enjoyment of something, there is attachment. And whenever there is attachment, and this is in the area of the sensual world, in the area of possessiveness, whenever there is attachment, you are creating, bound to create suffering for yourself in the future. And this is what he understood. And for that reason, he decided then to leave that ordinary household life. And of course, the next thing he does, all of you obviously know this story, but it's good just to recall it very briefly before we move on. The next thing he does, he goes and studies some meditation under Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, and then he goes to practice the ascetic practices, right? Not really ascetic practice, more like what they call here the self-mortification, the Atta Kilamatanu Yoga. He practices that, he tortures himself. And as it says in the sutta, this is in the Mahasachika Sutta, I think, and he says that he takes the self-mortification to the extreme. And if he had taken it any further, he would have died, right? He takes it to the very, very extreme of what is possible. So So this is kind of the backdrop here. He has practiced the two extremes in life, taken both of them to the maximum of what you can achieve, and none of them work. And that is why the Buddha has to rethink, and he has to think, is there another way to awakening? And this is the backdrop that, of course, that other way is then the Noble Eightfold Path, practicing the jhanas and the te vidya, and then that is how it happens. And that is why the very first thing the Buddha teaches his monks is precisely that middle way, right? It fits into that historical context. He has seen, he has understood what the path to real awakening actually is. So it says here that this is a path that should be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. And the reason, of course, is because you are fully abandoning the sensual pleasures. It doesn't mean that this path is not applicable to lay people as well. It is, of course, applicable, but it is probably more fully the path of a monastic than it is to lay people. But it is, you know, same leaning in the same way. Although, of course, if you are fully ordained as a monastic, it is more powerful. You're taking up the path more completely if you do that. And then it says here, and I'm just going to comment on a few of the things, of the words that are being used here. One of them is the pursuit of sensual happiness in sensual pleasures. Right? So this is the kamesu kamasukali kanu yogo. It is not entirely the way the translation is done here into English. It may not be entirely clear what is happening, what this means, but it means the pursuit of sensual happiness in the objects, in the sensual objects of the world, right? The Pali word kama, means two things. It means the personal sense of desire. And that is usually how you find it in the singular, in the suttas. There's a distinction between the singular and the plural. And it also refers to the objects of sensuality in the world. Everything we hear, everything we see, everything we taste, everything we touch, and everything we smell, right? The five bases of sense pleasures. It refers to all of those objects as well. And especially when we're talking about the plural, it refers to those things. So a better translation here, in my opinion, would be the pursuit of sensual happiness in the sensual objects of the world, the objects of the five senses. And then it becomes more clear, I think, what is going on. I think that is an important distinction in the suttas, this idea that kama actually means slightly different things when it is used in the singular, when it refers to the personal desire, right, is equivalent to tanha roughly, to loba perhaps, to raga. All of these things are about the desire, a personal desire, subjective feeling of personal desire. Whereas in the plural, it often usually refers to the objects outside. So you don't seek happiness there, which is low. Low is hina, right? Often, sometimes I say that's inferior. As in same word as you find in Hinayana, Mahayana, the same word, low, inferior. Vulgar, the word for that is the gammo, and gammo is related to the word gama, which is means like village. So it means like relating to the village. So it means like common, right? What that which is of the ordinary people. This is what ordinary people pursue. They pursue sensual pleasures. So it is relating to ordinary or common people. The word vulgar in English is very kind of a strong word, and these days it doesn't mean common or ordinary anymore. So I think it would be better here to translate which is inferior, which is common, right? Then we have the way of the worldling. This is Portu Janiko. Portu Janika is Putu, many jhana people, the many folk, the ordinary people, again, of the ordinary people. So which is inferior, common, which is the way of the ordinary people, which is ignoble, again, the opposite of the Aryas, right? Anaryo, the opposite of the noble beings who go beyond the sensual pleasures. And it is unbeneficial. Anatta Sanghita. The Atta in Buddhism, the Atta is the goal of the practice, is what we're aiming at, is where we're heading here, right? The atta is what we're trying to achieve. And sensual pleasures is here said to be unbeneficial, right? The vast majority of people in the world think that sensual pleasures are very beneficial. They're running around pursuing sensual pleasures all the time. And this is like the benefit. This is the benefit of working hard. This is the benefit of making money, is actually sensual pleasures. But the Buddha is saying that is not what the goal is about. The goal is beyond the sensual pleasures. And I think the majority of people, and this is a nice way of thinking about this, understanding the deficiency perhaps in pursuing sensual pleasures, is that if all you do in your life is run around pursuing sensual pleasures, you know, going from relationship to relationship, enjoying the material benefits of the world, whatever that might be, then when you die, when finally on your deathbed, and you look back on your life, you take stock of what you have done, you wonder, what was that all about? What was the point of that? I was running in around in the world, I was enjoying myself, but I haven't actually gone anywhere, and I haven't actually moved forward. I haven't developed myself. Now I'm going to die, I'm going to probably move on into another existence, and there's nothing I can take with me, right? So this is the kind of the pointlessness. It is not, there's no, ultimately, there's no benefit in this. However, if you look at this life in a very different way, and you understand right now the that sensual pleasures is not something that actually takes you anywhere, and you start developing those things that you can actually take with you into the future, which means developing the mind, right? You take a beautiful mind with you into the future. If you focus on that, then when you die, then when you are on your deathbed, you think back and you think, wow, I've actually used my mind for something useful. I'm a better person now than when I was born. I'm a better person when you're a baby. That's maybe a bit unfair to compare to a baby. But when I was like 20 or whatever, when I was an adolescent or whatever it is, I'm a better person. I've evolved. I've used my life in a skillful way. It is atta sanghito. It is connected with what is beneficial. And that is... So this is kind of what this means, right? Those things that are beneficial and those things that are not beneficial. And in this way, sensual pleasures is not beneficial. So that is the way the Buddha describes sensual pleasures. It's quite tough, right? He doesn't kind of mince his words. And sometimes it's very hard to understand these things. Sometimes it's very hard to understand because for the majority of people, sensual pleasure seems like fun. We should go out and enjoy ourselves, have a good life. And it takes a kind of higher view, the kind of view that you start to develop in the meditation practice when you start to let go of these things and you start to experience other types of happiness that are more profound, more pure, and more beautiful than sensuality. The happinesses that have nothing to do with craving. And you see the peace of mind when craving starts to disappear, and you understand, this is higher, this is more powerful. So please, sometimes, I know that sometimes people, perhaps especially in the West, I don't know how, but in Sri Lanka you are so steeped in Buddhist culture, you're probably used to this way of thinking, but in the West people often, what? You can't say that, that, you know, enjoying yourself in sensual pleasures, because this is what people live for. It's like you're undermining the very purpose of life if you say these kind of things. And that is why it is important to point it out, because it gives you a sense of hope as well, that there is something more powerful in the world, something more meaningful than just pursuing sensuality. So that is the one way that the Buddha rejects. And then you have the other way, and that is the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, right? Dukkha, ignoble, and again, it's unbeneficial. If you spend your whole life just torturing yourself, then when you come to the end of your life, you also wonder, why did I do that? It hasn't gotten me anywhere. And it's painful, it's dukkha. So the idea is not to pursue dukkha in the Buddhist life, but to pursue sukha instead. That is what the right practice is, as far as I can see in the Buddha's teachings. So then the Buddha says, without veering, without going towards either of these two extremes, right, these two kind of sides of things, the Buddha, the Tathagata, has awakened to the middle way, the Majjhima Patipada, which gives rise to vision, knowledge, peace, direct knowledge, awakening, and eventually Nibbana. So this is that famous middle way that the Buddha has awakened to her, and he has understood her. And I think it is important. I have talked about the middle way already quite a bit in terms of meditation practice. And I think it is quite important concept, this idea of the middle way here. When you look at the various spiritual traditions and religious traditions in the world, one of the things that you see when you look at that, there seems to be a very strong tendency in the human mind to think that torturing yourself, to think that experiencing pain is somehow beneficial. Right? You see that in the Hindu tradition, in the Brahmanical tradition, in the suttas, many of the Brahmins were also pursuing these kind of self-mortification. You see it in the Jains, right? The Jains are very, very big on this kind of thing. You see it in Christianity. You have this idea of flogging yourself, right? It's very good to kind of hurt yourself to the maximum. And apparently you also find it in Islam as well. So almost all these different religions have this idea that pain is what is required to achieve happiness. And of course in English you have the expression, no pain, no gain, right? So in other words, pain is good. Pain is something useful. So because of that, it seems to be a very deep-seated psychological tendency in human beings, right? We tend to be something that is almost part of us. And for that reason, we see it also, as I said before, we see it also in Buddhism. It's very common in Buddhism that people will sit with lots of pain and they will endure that pain. Sometimes the idea is that you will burn off karma and the sankharas will kind of disappear if you do that. Or other times people, as monastics, sometimes do too many austere practices. And I know many monks who have been doing, for example, the Nisabshika practice, the sitter's practice, for years and years and years. And after doing it for like 10 years, they said, I'm wasting my time. I'm not getting anywhere. It doesn't work. So be very careful, both as lay people and also as monastics, not to do things that are counterproductive. If you look at the Dutangas aren't mentioned very much at all in the suttas. It's only when you come to places like the Visuddhimagga that the Dutangas become very prominent. And particularly the very austere Dutangas, like the Nisabshika practice, right? It's very austere. And it's only mentioned in the suttas, maybe once or twice. It is incredibly rare in the suttas. And it occurs in context and in areas which are not very central to the Buddhist teachings. These are kind of side teachings you find that are not very important at all. So please be careful with these things. It is so easy to think that this is good things, and often people are impressed by these things, right? If you're a very austere monk, it often impresses people. And that is also one reason why it's easy to go in that direction. But of course, we're not really living this life to impress anybody. We're living this life to move towards awakening. So please keep in mind this middle way, because it's so easy and it's so natural, I think, in human psychology to actually go the wrong way. Anyway, so again, just a little bit more about the middle path. And if you practice that middle path, all these beautiful things arise as a consequence. It gives rise to vision, right? Dasana in Pali. This idea of seeing things. And again, it reminds me of the beautiful epithet of the Buddha. He is called the eye of the world. So again, this idea, the Buddha arises. He sees things as they actually are. He becomes the eye for everybody else because he has seen. He can tell everybody else, this is what it's like. And then we can follow in the footsteps. And if we follow in the footsteps, we too will eventually see. Dasana, right? It gives rise to vision. It gives rise to knowledge, jnana, the deep knowledge, the insight is perhaps here the more appropriate word in English. It gives rise to upasama, peace. And again, when the Buddha uses words like this, when the Buddha uses the word like upasama, he doesn't just mean like a little bit of peace, right? What is meant here is the deepest form of peace that is possible to attain by human beings. This is the real upasama, very, very profound, profound things. Direct knowledge, this is abhinya, usually the six direct knowledges in the suttas. And then we have sambodhi, enlightenment. And here I think awakening to me is a more meaningful translation than enlightenment, you awaken to something. You see something for the first time. It's like you're waking up and the darkness gets dispelled. The light gets turned on and you see what is going on. And finally, it leads to Nibbana. So these are the things, and toward the very last word here, Nibbana. One of the things that I have often wondered about is whether the word Nibbana should be translated into English or whether it should be left as Nibbana. And I think there are arguments in either direction. But the word Nibbana essentially means something, that something is extinguished, right? So one perhaps possible translation for Nibbana is extinguishment. Right? So you gain awakening and you gain extinguishment. Now, when you hear the word Nibbana and when you hear the word extinguishment, it very often leads to very different perceptions. If you hear the word extinguishment, it actually means something to you if you're an English speaker. It actually has a certain meaning. It means that something is gone out, right? Like a candle being extinguished. Something in your mind, like the defilements being extinguished. It has a certain meaning to you. But when you hear the word Nibbana, it feels like something uncertain, something unknown, something marvelous, something amazing, something that you can put almost any kind of meaning into, because it doesn't have any meaning to you. And this is I think an important point of Dhamma and perhaps of good translation, that if a word like Nibbana had a particular meaning to the ancient Indians at the time of the Buddha 2,500 years ago, and I think to them it may have meant precisely extinguishment, if it meant that to them, it is, in my opinion, we should also translate it into English, so that we experience, we feel the same thing that the ancient Indians felt when they heard the word Nibbana. So sometimes it's important to do that, because then you actually bring out the meaning, and it's not so easy to read all kind of meanings into these words. So that is one argument. A counter-argument to that would be that even at the time of the Buddha, it seems that Nibbana was like an elevated term that meant, in a sense, the end of the spiritual path. And if that is the case, then it might be okay to leave it untranslated as Nibbana. Anyway, I'm saying this thing just to kind of reflect on these terms, right? And I hope you don't mind me going into such detail. If you do, please complain, and I will use less detail from here on. Okay, so that is the first part about the middle way, and now the Buddha defines this middle way. What is that middle way here? And what, bhikkhus, is the middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision, etc., which leads to Nibbana? It is this Noble Eightfold Path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. This, bhikkhus, is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, and to extinguishment. So that is the middle way, and that middle way is the middle way where the body falls away, right? There's no pain in the body, as we have just seen. There is no pleasure gotten through the body. So this is the way of the happiness of the mind. That is essentially what this path is about. And with each of the steps on the Noble Eightfold Path, the defilements are decreasing. And as the defilements are decreasing, the happiness and the pleasure of the mind increases. The suffering of the mind goes down. The nivaranas are the things that give rise to suffering and problems. And the less there are of them, the more beautiful and the more powerful the mind becomes. And the end point of this path is Samma Samadhi, where you kind of reach the highest, one of the highest experiences of happiness that is available in the world, that pure, powerful bliss of the mind. That is the middle way awakened to by the Tathagata. Who is the Tathagata? What does that word mean? And if you want to read about the meaning of that word, you can look into the commentaries. It gives you a large number of possible meanings. But I think basically the word Tathagata is basically one of these words that was used in India at that time. It was used not just in Buddhism, but it was used generally in Indian society. And it seems basically just to mean somebody who is kind of special, right? Somebody has awakened to some profound truth. So it's like a slightly, maybe a slightly mystical word to give a sense of somebody who has gone beyond the ordinary things of the world. And here, of course, it is the way that the Buddha refers to himself. So that is the middle way, and now we can go on to the other three noble truths, and we'll do them one by one. Now this, because is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, union with what is displeasing is suffering, separation from what is pleasing is suffering, not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. So this is how the Buddha summarizes the first noble truth of suffering. And some of these things in this particular list, you may think that they are very obvious, right? I'll skip birth for now. But the second one here is aging is suffering. The Pali word for aging is jara, and jara is doesn't actually mean aging. So this is actually here in this case the translation is definitely wrong. Jara means old age, right? So really it should mean old age is suffering here. And you may think it is obvious, of course, old age is suffering. Every one of us have probably noticed that already. As you get older, the body is just more problematic, right? And when we're talking about old age here, we mean the very kind of final stages of life, right? When no longer nothing is really working anymore, the senses are shutting down, you cannot see, you cannot hear, you cannot do anything but for yourself, and everybody has to help you around. And it's not just suffering physically, it's also suffering mentally. Sometimes you feel too proud to have everybody do everything for you, you know, absolutely everything in life has to be done by others. And it is you may think this is obvious, but there is a reason, of course, why the Buddha mentions this. Why does he mention such obvious things? And the reason why he mentions things that seem so obvious is that although we know this in a kind of superficial way, very often we forget these things. Old age is suffering. Actually, to really take that on board, and I will talk about the contemplation of old age later on, if you really take that on board, it actually means that your whole attitude to life begins to change. So we know it in one way. In another way, we don't know these things. We know it superficially, but we don't know it deep down. And because we don't know it deep down, the Buddha actually points this out to us, that this is an important reflection, an important contemplation on the Buddhist path. And we will talk specifically about these contemplations later on, how to develop these things. Illness is suffering. Again, you will think it was obvious. Of course, illness is suffering. But again, when we get ill, we always say that, oh, something is wrong with me, right? As if this is counter to nature. But of course, illness is part of nature, and that is part of the problem. Nothing has gone wrong with you when you're ill. It has gone right with you when you're ill. It is actually just part of nature. You should never feel let down when you get sick. This is just the way things have to be. And again, it's a lack of understanding the nature of illness, which means that we think things go wrong when we are ill. Death is suffering. Again, this is perhaps one of the most powerful of these contemplations, because this is, you know, this is can often be very big suffering for people to die. And you can see that people go to, I have seen many people dying as a monk, and I'm sure many of the monastics here, you have also seen that people dying. And often people find it very hard to die. Some people are very good, they're very peaceful, and if you have practiced, lived a good life, and done the right things, it is much easier. But the less of the right things you have done in life, the more difficult the process of death is. And this too is something we need to contemplate. The contemplation of death is one of the most important contemplations in the suttas. You see it again and again and again in the suttas. And for that reason, I want to talk about that too in some detail later on. It's a very uplifting and beautiful contemplation if it is done in the right way. But then I want to briefly also touch upon birth is suffering, right? Why does the Buddha say that birth is suffering? It sounds kind of strange. All these other things we can kind of understand. But what about birth? Now, the first thing to understand about this is that, remember, the first noble truth, suffering, is what we have to overcome. Right? So, if birth is suffering, it doesn't mean that it was suffering when we got born, you know, so and so many years ago. That is not what it means. What it means, because we are going to overcome suffering, it must be a reference to future birth. It must mean rebirth, right? So, future birth, whenever we get born again into the future, that is what is meant by this particular thing. It doesn't mean the birth in this life, that's already finished. We can't do anything about that. The only dukkha that we can do something about is the dukkha of future birth. And for that reason, when it says here jati, it is specifically a reference to rebirth and birth in the future. That is an important thing to understand. And what that means, that again, you can see how the idea of rebirth, of samsara, is completely integrated into the Four Noble Truths. It is part of the Four Noble Truths, right? From the very beginning, it's integrated into them. But I suppose one could also ask the question, why is it that birth is suffering at all? And you could probably argue that the very fact of being born, right, of kind of being in a safe place in your mother's womb, right, and then coming into the world, is very kind of, seems very unreasonable. You're nice and safe, and then you have to come into the brutal reality of the world. That, of course, probably is a degree of suffering in itself. And maybe the whole process of being born is probably some degree of suffering there. But I think there might be more to this. And one of the ways that I like to think of the idea that birth is suffering, this comes from what you often, when you hear about people having near-death experiences, or when people have go into deep stages of samadhi as well. But let's take the near-death experience as an example, because it's very there's a lot of literature available on that issue, on that particular subject these days. And what happens when people have a near-death experience is they often have this feeling of leaving the body, right? And when you leave the body, what is the experience that people have when they do that? And it's experience of happiness. It's experience of being released from oppression, right? Wow, how nice it is to be out of that physical body. That physical body is such a pain. That's what people realize. And very often when they understand that they actually will have to go back into the physical body again, that's why it's called the near-death experience, because you go out and you come back again. Often you don't want to go back in, because you regard that physical body as something painful, something unpleasant. Right? And I think maybe for some people it's a similar kind of thing that happens when you die, right? Sorry, when you get reborn. It's like finally you get released from this body and you feel really at ease, you feel really relaxed. And then somebody tells you, or just nature tells you, now you have to go back in again, right? And you get trapped in this tiny little thing, this little thing in your mother's womb, right? This little kind of material thing which is there, and you can't really do anything about it. Get trapped into this world and back into the thing that you have just gotten released from. And I think that can be perhaps a very traumatic experience, being forced into this very limited physical form, which is the form of a fetus. This is one of the ways that I like to reflect on the idea that birth is suffering, the idea that being trapped into this physical form that we have. Okay, so those are the four main types of suffering at the beginning here. Then we have the next one is the union with what is displeasing is suffering. And this, of course, is a very broad category of things. But there are so many things in life when we have union with things that are displeasing. There are people that we don't feel comfortable around. When we hear speech, people tell us something we don't really want to hear, right? When the body becomes painful, all of these things are part of the thing, union with what is displeasing. But really, every time we feel something which isn't nice, every time we are feeling something which goes against our craving, right, that we are averse against, which isn't nice, that is really union with what is displeasing. And hardly a moment goes by, hardly an hour goes by, continuously pretty much, we are in union with what is displeasing, right? We're sitting here and we have to move around, we have to shift our posture. That is also union with what is displeasing. It's almost a very continuous thing in life. And then we have the separation from what is pleasing is suffering. And again, it's a similar kind of thing. Whenever we have achieved something which is nice, and that niceness disappears, again, that is unpleasant. And again, this is a very broad category, but of course the most important things in life are the things like friends and family members, often our dearest possessions, the things that are really dear to us. These are the things that are really problematic and really make it difficult when these things disappear. And this is also one of those important contemplation in the suttas, one of the five themes of contemplation, the contemplation that everything that is dear and pleasing to me will become otherwise. Right? This is again, we can see how these things are integrated into each other. The themes of contemplation are reflected directly in the Four Noble Truths. I'm not going to go on too much about these things, because these things are fairly obvious. We know what this means, but it's good to contemplate it, to understand how pervasive they are, how they run our lives almost completely. Last one, not to get what you want in suffering, right? It's a similar kind of thing again. You crave, right? You run after things. You try to make money. You try to kind of achieve things in life. You get an education. You try to get this particular relationship, perhaps. Whatever it is, you run after things. You crave for things. And you don't even get it very often, right? That, of course, again, is very disappointing and suffering. And again, it is quite obvious why that is the case. But again, it's important to remember these things. But then we come to the most profound one of this explanation of suffering. And this is the last one. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. The Panchupadana Khanda. This is suffering. And this is more difficult to understand what this means, because the five aggregates, it's a very common question that I get as a Buddhist monk is, well, what do these five aggregates actually mean? Right? And you get that question, and then a year goes by, and then the same person comes back and says, asks again, what do these five aggregates mean? And a year goes by, they come back. What do they actually mean? And it seems to be very hard for people to get a really good grasp of these five aggregates. What does it actually really mean? Okay, you say it means physical form, it means feeling, it means perception, it means the will, the sankhara, it means vijnana, right? But often when we divide it up in this way, it's very theoretical, it's not very practical, and it can be very often be very difficult to relate to. So how can we understand the aggregates in a way that they can be related to and that they can actually be understood? And the Buddhist teaching is always very practical. And a very easy way of understanding the Panchupadana Khanda, the five aggregates, is to know that they are basically just about experience. So when you say the five aggregates, what you're talking about is experience. And not just the Panchupadana Khanda, but also the six sense spaces, right? The six ayatanas, that is also really about experience. We experience the world through the six sense spaces. And many of these categories in Buddhism are just different ways of understanding human experience. So that's what it is like. So right now, while you're sitting here, what are you experiencing? What you are experiencing is the five aggregates. Right? That's what you're experiencing. You're feeling the form. That's the physical form. You're feeling something, right? Maybe you are enjoying this retreat. Maybe you don't. Maybe you hate this retreat, right? You have some kind of feeling one way or the other. Maybe you're completely neutral. Maybe you're just equanimous about it. You're feeling something about this. You have perception. Perception is just what you are seeing is part of your perception. You're seeing the people around you, your ability to make sense of what is happening around you. This is part of that perception. You see a tent, you see the nature outside, you hear the sounds. All of this is part of the perception aggregate. You have a will, you have something that you want to do whenever you move, whenever you attend to things in a certain way. That is the will, the sankhara being active. And then vijnana is just the awareness. So right now, your experience in this very moment is the five aggregates. That is all it is. And so the aggregates, the five aggregates, can be understood very simply as experience. As you go through life, from life to life, from birth to birth, from one experience to another one, all you ever have is the five aggregates. That's all that ever goes with you as you go through these things. And that is what really the five aggregates are about. So what this means then, it means that the five aggregates, specifically the five aggregates that refer to, that are about clinging, the five subject to clinging, these are suffering. It means that experience is suffering. That's what this means. Right? Experience is suffering. And this is why this is so profound, because it means that every moment, every time we experience something, from the higher perspective of the Buddhist path, from the perspective of awakening, from the Buddha's perspective, it is suffering. Every moment of experience is suffering. And this is why, you know, this is the only way you can really start to understand that, is by starting to shut down, to reduce experience in life. And this is what we do through the process of meditation. Experiencing is becoming less and less, right? This is why talking about the disappearance of the body in meditation practice. When the body disappears, you experience less, right? We close our eyes, we don't see what is going on. The other senses are also fading away. What does it feel like when all the senses, when the body, when everything is fading away? It feels happy, right? You start to get some idea that experience actually is a problem. The more experience there is, the more sense data you receive through the doors of the senses, the more painful it is, the more agitated it is, the more restless it is, the more difficult it is. The more things close down, the more peaceful things become. The less you experience, the more happiness you have. This is actually the reality of things. And I'm sure every one of you already can start to relate to that. And because you can relate to that, you can start to relate to why the five aggregates, why the Panchapadana Khanda are suffering. And this is how, so if you extrapolate from that experience in ordinary meditation practice, and you look forward to the kind of potential for everything to settle down, everything to become peaceful, you can start to understand why everything, all the Panchapadana Khandas, all experience ultimately is suffering one way or another. So this is the most profound understanding of the Buddha's teachings. Again, it's very difficult to fully grasp this. To some extent it has to be taken on faith, but to some extent you can also start to get a grip on this by looking at your own meditation experience. So I should maybe very, very briefly say something about the translation here again. The word aggregate in English is a very kind of technical word. It just means a grouping of phenomena, right? So all phenomena that are feeling related are part of the Vedana Khanda. So this is the feeling Khanda, the feeling aggregate. All phenomena related to perception, right, being able to make sense of the world, that is part of the Sanya Khanda, the Sanyupadana Khanda. So these aggregates are just collections of phenomena in the world. Vijnana, all marks, all types of consciousness are part of that. It's a bit unfortunate that sometimes the translations we have, they become very technical and can become hard to understand. I'm always in favor of making translations as transparent as possible, so we can straight away grasp what is going on with these translations. So, and these aggregates are subject to clinging. What that means is that we cling to experience, right? Experience is really all we have. There is nothing in the world that is outside of experience. Experience is all there is. I'm sure you're familiar with the very well-known, the Rohitasa Sutta. Rohitasa is a very famous, fairly well-known sutta found in the Anguttara Nikaya. And Rohitasa says he wants to go to the end of the world, right? And he talks about how he tried to go through the various, various kind of different realms, trying to find the end of the world. And then the Buddha replies very famously, the world is found in this fathom-long body with its mind and with its perception. The end of the world, or the beginning of the world, is found in this body with its mind and perception. The end of the world is found in this body with its mind and perception. It's right here, right? It's in this mind, this body, this being. This is what the world actually is. It's the world of experience. In Buddhism, the world is the world of experience. That is what matters. All we can possibly ever know is experience, and there really isn't anything outside of that. So when we cling to something, when we attach to something, upadana means this taking up, holding on to things, what we cling to is experience itself. Okay, so that is the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering itself, and it is, again, it is very profound, and for that reason it's worth reflecting a little bit on. I will quickly look at the three, that's the most important noble truth as far as I'm concerned. We will look at the other ones fairly quickly as well before we end for this morning. So the Buddha then goes on. Now this, because is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. So craving is the problem, right? Craving is what binds us to rebirth. Specifically, the craving which leads to renewed existence. The porno bhavika tanha. Porno, again, bhavika, existence. Literally, again, existence, to rebirth. Right? So again, you can see here the idea of rebirth is absolutely crucial to the Four Noble Truths. It is found in the First Noble Truth. It is also found in the Second Noble Truth. Right? It's integrated into the very essence of the Dhamma. It is that craving which leads to rebirth, which is the problem. Which means perhaps maybe other cravings aren't so bad. Maybe there are certain desires, certain things that we crave which aren't so bad. Right? If you crave to live the spiritual life, if you crave to keep the precepts, well, that is not really part of this. So a little bit of desire to lead the spiritual life, to meditate and to keep the precepts is necessary. If you haven't got that desire, it won't happen. So this specific craving, and that specific craving is, first of all, it is accompanied by, it says, delight and lust, nandi raga. Raga, just another word for sensual desire. Delight, nandi, the delighting in things, the delighting in the world. So these are just basically just synonyms for tanha. They mean roughly the same thing here. Seeking delight here and there. Tatra, tatra, abhinandini. And this means that there is no end to craving, right? There's always a place, always something else to crave for. There's always another object which looks delightful. There's no end to the search for things in the world to crave for. That is essentially how I understand that one. And these cravings that are bad, these cravings that lead to renewed existence and to suffering, specifically, are the craving to sensual pleasures, craving to existence, and craving for extermination. And the most important one of these is the craving for existence. So we have just looked at the First Noble Truth, and the five aggregates can be summarized as existence, right? Existence is the five aggregates. There's no existence outside of the five aggregates. So basically, it means craving for the five aggregates. If people ever crave for anything, it's always the five aggregates. Now, the five aggregates, I have just said, really just means experience, right? We want to experience things. We want to experience the world. So one way of understanding the craving for existence is it is the craving to experience. We would rather experience things because we want to exist, right? Existence and experience are very, very related to each other. We want to experience because we want to exist. We want to exist because we want to experience. And not to experience is considered worse than experiencing things. So that is why we want to go on. We want to move on. And this, of course, is very strongly related to the idea of a self. We have a sense of self. We want to go on. The self wants to experience the world. And that's why we want to move on in this way. But then to understand the world, that actually, if that experience we're having is suffering, right? That undermines the very idea of craving. Craving is no longer required. If you understand that what you're craving for is suffering, then of course the craving stops. So craving for existence, craving for sense pleasure, this is just another aspect of existence. You're craving for the pleasures of the world. It is singled out because it is one of the most important cravings to that binds us to the wheel of existence. Once you overcome sensual pleasures and you get into the deep states of samadhi, you're actually getting very close already to nibbana. Getting very close. Once you get to samadhi, you're getting very close. And the biggest obstacle on the path is sensual pleasures, the objects of the world. This is what really ties us to the wheel of samsara more than anything else. And that is the reason why I think it is singled out here. And the last one, which is the craving for extermination. This is when you've had enough, you want to commit suicide, you want to make an end of it all. And then, unfortunately, you commit suicide, you want to make an end of it all. You are in a desperate state. And unfortunately, that actually leads to rebirth, because it is a craving. You are you want to achieve extermination, and this craving is always about the future. You want to exterminate yourself in the future. And because it is about future, you are kind of propelling yourself into a renewed existence as a consequence. This is different from the Dhamma. In the Dhamma, what we are seeking for is cessation, the ending of things. Not exterminating anything. We don't want to destroy anything. We want to allow things to cease on their own accord when tanha disappears. Okay, the last two noble truths fairly quickly. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishment of it, the freedom from it, and the non-reliance on it. Again, it is the remainderless fading and cessation of the same craving. The same craving, in other words, the craving we were talking about in the previous noble truth. The craving that leads to rebirth, right? So again, the idea of rebirth is also part of this noble truth. So three noble truths so far, you find the idea of rebirth being intricately, completely involved with that noble truth. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that craving, right? The ending of this craving, this is the sort of thing that you start to see as you practice your meditation practice. It starts to cease and fade away stage by stage. But not only does the craving cease, but you relinquish it completely. And this is the final abandoning of craving, the relinquishment, the patinisaga and the chaga, the giving up of that craving. This is the complete ending of craving. It can never arise again. It fades away. Then it ceases, then eventually you give it up completely, because you understand that you're just craving for suffering. Once you understand that you're craving for suffering, it's very easy to give up. The freedom from it, right? It is an oppression. You understand craving is a problem. It is something which is very, you have to endure and bear, because it is painful. But finally, you are released from this problem. And the non-reliance on it, the analaya, analayo of craving. Analaya is like alaya is like resting on something, attaching to something. The Himalayas, the Himalaya mountains, Hima means snow, alaya is the resting place, is where the snow is resting, Himalaya. And this here is where the resting, you don't allow craving to rest anymore inside of you. Craving is given up, you don't identify it, and you give it up completely. And then, that is a very quick summary of the third noble truth. And then the last one is the fourth noble truth, of course, and again, it is the Noble Eightfold Path. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this Noble Eightfold Path, that is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. Okay, so that is the Four Noble Truths for you in brief. That is a very quick exposition of these Four Noble Truths. It is very profound. It is very hard to fully grasp why it is that craving always must lead to rebirth. These are very deep things, and it's really only through understanding Paticca-samuppada, dependent arising, that you can see these connections fully, 100%. So don't really only the stream mental, I can fully understand what this is, what is going on here. But I'm sure you can get a feeling for these things, right? And the more of a feeling you have for these Four Noble Truths, the more you're heading in the right direction, and the more easy it will to bridge that last gap and actually gain the full insight when you are ready for the full insight after a state of samadhi in the future. But because these are fairly profound and because they are difficult to understand, the Buddha also explains right view in a different way here. And this is a way which is easier to understand, and it is often more practical. And that is what I want to move on to this afternoon at 3 o'clock. Then we will have a look at this other side of right view. So I'll see you again at that time.